Twin Visions at the Rutberg Fine Arts Gallery in Los Angeles, Part 2. You are tuned in to KCBX listener-supported public radio, and this is Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas. KCBX serves the California Central Coast from Ventura to Salinas. I am Stephen DeLuque. Co-host Krista Hewitt and I are again at the Jack Rutberg Fine Art Gallery, located at 357 North La Brea Avenue in Los Angeles. Jack has managed the impossible by presenting a joint show of works by identical twin brothers, painter Jerome Witkin and photographer Joel Peter Witkin. Jack joins us as Krista inquires of Joel how his interest in photography first began.
Joel, do you remember when you first used a camera, what that experience was?
I don't remember that, but it was a plastic Japanese camera that took two images. And I remember going around, and I wanted to basically know that one image would relate to the other. It was so made that you can photograph one side, and then that would be blocks. You can photograph the other side. That was, to me, very, very interesting. I'm still, even though I pretty much know the basic as far as what happens to silver and light and paper and film, because I work in the classic way. Every time I put a print in the soup, or the developer, say, in the chemistry, it's always magical. So a long time ago, you know, it's a question of other people have done the kind of objective work, and my job is to do the opposite. One of the things I did for the Reina Sofia Museum was, and Jerry helped me too, was a carpenter made this cross, but I made a photographic crucifix on a one-to-one basis of, I got this model, whose name was Carl Love. That's a good place to start. And I tried to have him hypnotized because I didn't want him to move. It was going to save myself time. But he's now a lawyer living in Salt Lake City. And his concept is very different, but he looked great. And we wounded him up with makeup and everything else. I rented a camera that was a one-to-one, a macro camera that gave me, of course, the same proportions. And the whole deal was that I would photograph. I actually photographed 179 rolls of film, which I processed mechanically. I rented a mechanical processor. Then I contacted everything. And then those contacts were put on lead, which wasn't too good for me. But I cast his body. I have a degree in sculpture from Cooper Union 2 that helped. Made a mold and a cast. And then we nailed those pieces back on the body with little nails, and that took months. But I really want to change. I mean, everyone wants to somehow understand and then go beyond the media that they're working in, because that's the contribution, not the fact that it's so wacko. It has to be meaningful, purposeful, and should be astonishing. I mean, I think that's what drives us. I'm working on something right now that is... It's the busboy at the Last Supper. You can laugh.
Oh, yes, we laugh.
You were never there. So what this is going to be is I have to find the right kind of guy. But it's going to be a bust, literally a bust, of a guy with kind of curly hair, little beard, dark skin, will be made up and lit very, very, very theatrically, because it has to be dimensional. And then around his neck is going to be a tray with whatever, you know, fruit and grapes and whatever for the Last Supper. Then the whole thing is going to be cut like a bust that you see on a little stand. And but it's going to be two-dimensional. But I'm hoping that to make it so that when you look at frontally only, it'll be very, very dimensional. And he's going to have this kind of like around his neck that goes over the tray and over his elbows. He has a kind of like a scarf or a rag or a towel. And so everything is very, very symbolic. It's going to be printed. And then, because I have presses for this, I can put the print on aluminum and then cut both of them out. The aluminum will be cut to match the paper. And then it's going to be painted. I'll make a maquette first, and we'll see. I might make several images like this, because when I think about it, you know, what I do and what painting is, it's a flat surface. And I like the idea of, you know, we all, especially in photography, you're kind of given trompe l'oeil, and in painting and drawing, you basically have to create it. But I want to basically accept what's there and then see how far I can basically change things around. And working with illusion. And I think that's going to be interesting. That'll keep me going for a while.
I want to take that also. He said pushing something. And I think if I actually would, when I develop some drawings into paintings, if I said this aloud to people, it would sound ridiculous. But the one thing is, visually, I think I'm on the right track. So it is not ridiculous. And I think, you know, I tell my students, especially the ones who just don't trust themselves, to kind of be bad, like, you know, be a bad boy. Just like, you know, push your mother down the stair, or just hit your father. I don't know, do something that, you know, pushes your limit, pushes your definition. But being brave, I think, is part of the creative process, too. I mean, you're not going to stay like a nude woman next to flowers is the core of my visual world. It's a cliche. So how do you make something appear like a marvelous vision? You know, if you go to Rome and go to the Chiesa dei Francesi and see the Caravaggi paintings, there's one, of course, where the man has fallen off a horse with a vision, the great painting. And, you know, he's blinded for a time, and then he sees. I think the creative process is the same way. We are blinded by the possibility of an idea, and then you see it. And then you have to know you've arrived at something. And I think that is the strength of, I think, the work here. I have no memory about how long things take. It always seems, I'm shocked when I see 2 years ago I began this painting, or 3 years ago, but it didn't seem like any time is left or lost. And, you know, there's this flattening of time, just like the canvas is a flat surface, but what's in that flatness is the dream we have. So I think we are talking very twin-like here all the time.
Including that twin camera, the very first one. You know, I think, though, for your listeners, that we need to somehow try to give a hint as to what we're actually looking at. And I think, for example, in the case of Joel, an audience that may be new to his work, they think in terms of photography as something that we all see. Well, Joel has described some of the process and his intent. There is an attribute to Joel's work which is rather extraordinary. In Jerome's case, there are paintings here which depict the indescribable. That's the remarkable DNA that they share, is this astounding ability to take us as viewer into realms that we don't expect. And it brings the viewer to their knees, because we have become so jaded in this age of film, cinema, computer, that we have forgotten how to look. I think that this 26-year-old victim here is perhaps the most extreme example of the notion of bringing the grotesque and the beauty together.
All of Joel's photographs, to me, they imbue a sense of respect for the people, that the images that are in there. And they are not victimized in any way, shape, or form. To me, they're a very respectful representation. Was that something that you do on purpose, or is this part of the natural process of your work?
Well, it's a respective form of love, and why I do it is because of love and the challenge of that particular engagement. When I was in graduate and postgraduate school, I had the opportunity to photograph corpses through the medical school, and I first thought it with fetuses, and then I was given the opportunity to actually witness an autopsy, as in this case. I've made actually a great deal of work with postmodern subjects all over the world. I've not done that for several years now because I've been kind of close to that view of myself, because there's no future in old age, really. As Jerome mentioned about ending that series of concentration camps, I am ending, or have maybe have ended, this work of concentrated loss, we'll say. Unless something comes up that's very wonderful, I'll consider it. But I don't go after that. What I'm doing now, especially, is something that is more joyous and is about the temporal nature of happiness rather than the deeper, darker aspects of termination.
I have to say that one of my favorite photographs of all time is the woman's face over there. Face of a Woman is a gelatin silver print of an embalmed head of a woman with the top of her skull removed, in where Joel has placed some flowers and foliage. The head rests on a cloth-covered table, and there is a taxidermied monkey sitting next to the woman's face. The contrast of the agitated expression of the monkey and the serene peacefulness of the woman's countenance is striking.
I did this in Marseille. There was a Dr. Solomon, who I work with. I don't know how it is in the States, because it's a different kind of medical universe, I guess, and how it's conducted, but he owns the subjects I photographed. And this particular one, he got it from another doctor. It was in a jar. It's probably about 60, 70 years old. And I was amazed. I saw it in this formalin, and I said, I'm going to do something with this. So I went back where I was staying. I was staying at a workman's hotel near the hospital. I just started to sketch what possibilities were, because across the street from this hospital is the Museum of Natural History, where I was photographing. And I remembered there was a taxidermed animals there. There was a florist nearby, an antique store. So I got this table and I got the head out. When I took the head out, I cleaned it, posed it, because everything here is basically structured. I put the monkey in there, and it took me about 20 minutes to put everything together. And I made another photograph in Marseille about flowers coming out of the person's head. The last thing I did after lighting is that I went back and did these little kinds of changes, like this hair is very important to me. Even this little kind of stuff that the twigs and the flowers. This was shot by with a 6x7 Pentax single lens reflex, and it's right side up, and I can design it as I'm working on it, and it's kind of like a depository. Everything I do is kind of a depository of form and interest and reality. This is unusual in the sense that it doesn't have any scratches. I did round the corners because I wanted the attention to be on the subjects. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very tender image. I mean, the subject matter is so powerful that it's a test of the ability of the recorder, in my case, the recorder, to basically engage something that she has no rights, a dead person, but I have to give her those rights. I have to give her that beauty and that purpose. That's basically, for me, is successful as an image, because it's not only beautiful and powerful, but is evocative. It's a vanitas. And it teaches us, or should teach us, about life and tenderness. It comes from the person, too. She's a very, very lovely woman. You have to believe, because it's there, that she's very beautiful. And I know that in the afterlife, she must be enjoying that, too. I was very lucky, very fortunate to find this face, this head of a woman. It was a gift to me, and I believe I made a gift to her.
I think it's a stunning image.
What I'm also finding just really special about these photographs, as we've already said, you're not just out there on the street documenting something that just happened, that the look of so many of them, I find myself going, is this really a photograph or is it a drawing? Because the textures, the shadows, the lights and darks, the almost sense of cross-hatching in some of them begins to take on a whole different kind of quality, which is another very special attribute to the work.
You're listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Our guests today are identical twin brothers, Jerome and Joel Witkin. Jerome is a painter. Joel is a photographer. After this pledge break, we'll be back with the second half of our interview.
We continue now with Joel Witkin.
I'm planning to go to Krakow for a kind of a work vacation, and there are two photographs I really must do. I love that city, and we'll see. And I'll be there for about 3 weeks. I want to make two images. It's a challenge. I basically rely on phenomenology and luck and destiny to basically put me in different places and situations that are challenging. And it's something that I didn't even think about first. And that's part of the involvement and the process. And as far as the printing, process the film in a very classic way. I spend a lot of time in the darkroom. I throw away about 60-70% of the work to get it right. For me, that's what I deal with. I deal in papers and chemistry to make a reality that those forms can give me, but it's very, very visceral. I bleach, I change, I tone. I wear respirators, different kinds of respirators, and it's very, very complex. It's emotional through that the technique.
Jerome, we've been talking a lot about staging of work, but you also have very, in my opinion, strong pieces of buildings often that you've gone out and painted. And the last time we were together, you told the wonderful story of, we're going to go look at it.
Into another gallery.
When you were painting one of these urban landscape pieces of someone driving by in a car.
This is a study for painting. It's called a site study for building at the corner of Prospect and Butternut. The thing is, across from the view of that building, which is a really like a tenement I knew from my childhood, if you go back this way, I'm actually standing in a drive-through bank situation. And I tend to kind of take the picture every day for maybe 5-6 days in a row and keep painting, then make adjustments in my studio as I remember it, even take some photographs if the light changed and something actually happened, shadows. So I was nearly finished the painting. It was a Sunday, and the street is a very dangerous area, like there's shootings and stuff like that. So I was painting, and nobody was near me because it was, I think, a Sunday. And suddenly this car zooms by, and I'm having a bad day anyway because I'm sort of screwing up on things that looked better a few days ago. It's one of those bad days where your hand is against you or something. And this car comes shooting by again, and it almost hits my elbow and knocks some easel kind of a, was jarred. And I thought, what the hell is happening? You know, is this a gangbanger? Somebody doesn't like me painting here? And suddenly the car came again, and it slowed down. And she, this woman, this large arm came out of the driver's side, and she had $3 in her hand. And she said, here, buy more paint. That's the story. Every time I go to these neighborhoods, and there are some pretty raw neighborhoods, that people have a big interest in why I'm there and why I'm celebrating and documenting places that they really haven't even looked at themselves. They pass by. And so, I mean, it's a funny story. And the thing is, I was about to give up for the day. And then when she said that, I kind of stayed and the picture did get better. So she gave me a gift. That's a story that actually was very pleasant, you know, because many times when I did this picture, I was actually under a lot of electrical poles. And I had to accept bird droppings because I couldn't move from the spot, you know, so I was given a different kind of gift. But and also this whole area there was the kind of municipal dumping ground for people's dogs, you know, dog turds. And the whole thing was like beyond poverty. It was just these abandoned buildings and the history of who could have lived there. And I really enjoyed the kind of melancholy of the place. And there's so much geometry, which is really quite beautiful. The geometry of this passage and then how this building has that cemented place. And you get a comment of ochre and then gray and ochre and gray. And there's a lot of musical touches in any painting. That tricycle was just there, and I actually moved it to a more central point and painted that. And in painting, you can get away with murder, like how things point to things. And it's quite beautiful.
Gallery owner Jack Rutberg.
Jerome isn't an illustrator. They feel like portraits. There's a presence there. Our own presence is usually the critical element. We feel like we're in the space. They're not merely depictions of buildings. I mean, you actually have the contrast of texture, light. Something has happened here. There's a life that has lived there. But I'd like to go back to something that Joel was saying, because it was interesting that he has this desire to go to Krakow, where some of Jerome's paintings have been seen. There was an exhibition curated at the museum called New Old Masters. And it was very provocative because it indeed included what it might be one of the most difficult paintings that Jerome has ever done, called The Butcher's Helper. It shows it's about a 22-foot, 24-foot painting, multi-paneled. And if you read it from right to left, you would see this woman who is on a bunk bed. I'm going to describe this rather graphically because it gives you a sense of the drama that is imbued in both of these artists' works. The woman has been amputated. The legs and arms have been amputated. She has clearly just been violated on this bunk bed by this German butcher with this this like a butcher's apron on, and he's leaving the room. You can see he's zipping up his fly. As he enters the other room, there are flayed carcasses of humans hanging as they were almost like great soutine paintings, but they're human carcasses hanging from hooks. And at the far end of it are the American soldiers liberating the scene. They're astounding, astounding subjects. What I alluded to early on, and what you see in some of these paintings, is the fact that both of these artists are describing and depicting scenes, places, and people that we have never seen before. I have yet to see a work by either of these artists that are evocative of another artist. You've never seen this work before, period. Now, of course, we have historical references. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But the bottom line is, with the exception when the artists are overtly paying tribute to another artist, what you really see here is two unique visions, and their works will remain throughout history for that reason alone. We understand the historical continuum that they're a part of, but they are part of that continuum and will serve as a milestone for others, as they already have. Both artists have legions of followers. In the other exhibitions that we have had of Jerome's paintings, we've had caravans of artists that came from, for example, Phoenix, Arizona. And when I suggested that there might be other shows they want to see in town, they said, oh no, you don't understand. We came for this. And after lunch, we're driving back to Arizona. So this is an amazing privilege for any viewer.
And one of the things that I would like to point out to our listeners is that these images are very, very difficult to look at. And that is part of the purpose, is the fact that there is indignities that are committed by humans against humans. And to ignore them is to forgive them.
I would concur with one added element, and that is to create a horrific work is very easy. To imbue it with humanity and empathy and a stunning facility that brings all those things together is a very different thing. I live with a very large painting of Jerome's in my living room, and I can tell you that the discovery never ceases, and the humility that I feel in its presence is something that I cherish greatly. So one will find that with both artists in every work in this show.
At this point, an off-mic question was asked of Joel as to how he would like to be remembered.
As a photographer who basically always went his own way and did what he had to do, and in the most honest and caring manner, I hope that I've presented some images that define the condition of the world and the condition of my own spirit.
A very interesting connection with Joel's statement about love, love for the people posing. He has a more decisively known person posing for him. I mix my models up. I take two or three people into one person, so they can become more of a fiction, more of a kind of symbol thing. I want to say also that when I look at the three paintings there, Three Men in a Ruin, which the first one is from my having gone to Auschwitz death camp in 1990, and I came back with a fantastic amount of desire, but I didn't know how to use that desire to do something about that. And Elie Wiesel, he said famously that no one could do images of the Holocaust because you had to be there. It's a detriment to even try. And I said, okay, I'll put myself in that position of trying, you know. When I made that picture, it just couldn't be about that one point of horror and, you know, blasphemy against human beings, that I had to do other things that are also about not love, as Joey puts it, but a kind of sense of regret. I kind of regret that human beings do what they do. My son, Andrew, who died 3.5 years ago, he was born with a blood disorder. He was also a kind of a prophet, a young child who, his first sentence when he was very tiny, he said, "Mommy, what people do?" That idea of the surprise of today's newspapers, you know, why people hurt each other so badly, why people starve each other, why people deny life to each other. I think, unfortunately, that's so much what people do. Taking on the idea of harm, the person harming themselves with drugs, or the person harming themselves with, like the Van Gogh character, who desperately is trying to make something beautiful, but his mind is not of that. I think that regret is important in my work. And I think it's more existential. It's more about reporting the time. I want to leave it there.
I have seen the redemptive power of these paintings in play. We had some of the Holocaust paintings in the back gallery. We had visitors where Holocaust victims had come into the room. One woman, in fact, she came up to Jerome with her fists clenched. She was beautiful, this white outfit and white hair. And she came up to Jerome and she confronted him. And I thought, uh-oh. And she says, "Mr. Witkin, I'm a Holocaust survivor." And she said, "You're the first one who understood." We've experienced drama in this gallery that goes beyond sensation. It's about the way we are affected on a personal basis.
This has been incredible, and we will encourage everybody to come down here to take a look at your work because it is exceptional. Jack has said, these are things that you will never see anywhere else. Thank you so very much, Jerome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Joel.
Thank you.
We would like to thank today's guests, painter Jerome Witkin and photographer Joel Peter Witkin, and of course, our host, Jack Rutberg. The Jack Rutberg Fine Arts Gallery has a website, which is www.jackrutbergfinearts.com. This is Stephen DeLuque, and for Krista Hewitt, we would like to thank our listeners for their continued support.